Hey everybody, welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is recording engineer Michael Frondelli. But first, let's get to the big news. It came out this week that so far in 2014, there's been not a single certified platinum record. Yes, you heard that right. So far this year, not a single album has sold a million. Now, once upon a time, this used to be very commonplace. Every year by this time, there'd be 20 to 30 albums that would have sold a million plus. And this, of course, includes both catalog and current releases. But nonetheless, there was a lot of sales that used to happen, but not so anymore. This year, there have been zero RIAA-certified platinum records. Now, why is this significant? Well, it just goes to show you that we're in a singles world today. And what drives that home is the fact that so far this year, there's been 60 platinum singles. So that means there have been 60 singles that have sold more than a million. Now, getting back to albums for a second, there actually was one album that sold more than a million. In fact, it sold 3 million. And that was the soundtrack from the movie Frozen. But that doesn't really count, mostly because Frozen is a soundtrack. It's not a popular artist. So if we look at the album, we can see that it has less and less influence almost every day as streaming becomes more and more a part of our lives. What's really interesting is the fact that you can have a single that can have 100 million views on YouTube and sell less than 10,000 copies. So streaming is now a fact of life, for better or for worse. I happen to think it's for the better, but this just goes to show you, it really hammers home the fact that we're in a singles world and we're in a streaming world. Okay, the next thing I want to talk about is overcoming loud stage volume. Let's say you're mixing an act live. I know most of you that listen do some live mixing, although for the most part, we kind of center around recording, but a lot of you do some live sound as well. And there's always a problem with stage volume. How do you deal with it? Usually, it's a guitar player. All you guitar players know that in order to get the sound that you like, the one thing that you have to do is crank your amp up. And it's a fact of life that almost any size amplifier just has to be cranked enough to really make it sound good. And especially if you're not using too many pedals to modify your sound, you'll find that this is even more of a factor. So the guitar player, in order to get the sound, really has to crank that amp and therefore can be out of balance with the rest of the band. So how do you deal with that? Well, the first thing is to ask the player to angle the amplifier. This would mean angle the amp towards the side of the stage, turn it around and face the back of the stage. Won't matter if it's mic'd, and it won't matter if you can put some of that back into the monitor system. But usually, that really does a lot to make the sound a lot more palatable for everyone involved. It'll bring the stage level down, and it'll also make it easier to mix, and it'll be easier on the audience as well. The second thing you can do is go to the player and, as kindly as you can, ask him or her to turn down. But when you do this, you have to make sure that you use kid gloves and basically say that it's not personal and it has nothing to do with the sound quality. It's not an attack on the sound quality. It just means that it's too loud. And if the player can possibly turn down a little bit to help you out, then that would be better for everybody concerned. This doesn't always work because a lot of players get easily offended to this, but it is another way to do it. The third thing you can do is probably the least favorable of all three, and that's to mix up to the stage volume. So in other words, through the sound system, whatever is the loudest, you mix up so everything sounds balanced. And what ends up happening as a result, you get a lot of complaints when it comes to that as well. This is less of a problem in a large venue, but it is a problem nonetheless. So obviously, it's not what you want to do. Some of the ways that you can actually make that work a little better is if you decrease around 2K a little bit, which is the center of human hearing. And if you decrease that a little bit, everybody will be a little happier. You'll get fewer complaints, but you'll still get them. So if you just tailor your frequency response a little bit, that could help. But generally speaking, mixing up the loudest thing on stage isn't really acceptable, especially in small venues. But nonetheless, those are the three ways to overcome a loud stage volume. You can either ask the player to angle the amp, or kindly ask the player to turn down, or mix up to the stage volume. you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is Michael Frondelli. He's worked on projects for Crowded House, Eddie Money, Kiss, Chicago, Aretha Franklin, Billy Idol, and many, many more. He's also an alumni of Electric Ladyland in New York, the famous studio, and we'll get to talk about that a little bit. I spoke with Michael from his studio via Skype. So, Michael, thanks so much for being on the podcast today. You're one of my favorite people to talk to, and I'm really happy that we get a chance to talk again.
Well, the feeling's mutual, Bobby. We've been friends for a long time, and I'm a great admirer of your work.
Well, likewise. But let's talk about you for a second. I know you, well, more than a second. We're going to talk all about you in this podcast. You started as a guitar player, and I know you still play a little bit, but how did you go from being a player to becoming an engineer?
At the time when I started, which was as a guitar player, was in the mid-60s, still in high school, looking at different bands after school, and then going to college and studying business in college and staying in bands or playing in bands through college. There was a time when looking at the option of going on tour with a band in the early 70s didn't look too attractive. And for those who remember, and I did not intend to become a recording engineer, but what had happened was, as a result of me getting all kinds of gigs doing road work and sound work and working in rehearsal studios, I worked at a studio called Baggy's Rehearsal Studio in downtown Manhattan in the early 70s, which was Mecca for Johnny Winter, John McLaughlin with Carlos Santana, with Love, Devotion, and Surrender, with Billy Cobham. I mean, it was amazing. Foghat, amazing opportunity. And as a result from working there, I came to California to work for Alembic Musical Instruments, and then came back and started building rehearsal studios. And then somebody said to me one time, you know, you got a really good work ethic. Would you be interested in learning the recording studio business or becoming a recording engineer? And I took the option. It was at Broadway Recording Studios, 1697 Broadway in the Ed Sullivan Theater building. A gentleman by the name of Alan Karp hired me, who was the chief. And the idea was that I was going to become a night maintenance technician. And he trained me, and it was on an old Scully M100, a two-headed multi-track, 16-track machine. And the owner, Pat Jakes, J-A-C-Q-U-E-S, Pat was, he was a ham radio fanatic. He was a great R&B engineer, though. I heard him do live to two-track mixes in the studio, do demos of R&B dates, and they were amazing. Another guy named Irv Greenbaum was in. He was a great Latin engineer. He was working with Fania and Coco Records, and Irv was a guy who came out of the military, and he would copy CW, Morse code, when Pat was broadcasting 2 meters FM out of the shop. And he would, you know, give us weather reports and things like that. It was kind of fun. But these guys were as old as my dad, and they were training me, or reluctantly training me, because I was the young kid. And, you know, I hadn't done what they had done, and they wouldn't answer questions. And I had to learn the answer to ask the question. So what they did teach me was signal path, and they taught me how to find my own answers. I would always say, well, I love that sound that you got. How did you get that sound? How did you do? What'd you do? And they would say, well, think about it. What happened here? What did we do? And they forced me to mentally look at signal path. So, and that's how I got the start into recording. And then from there, there was a, I don't know if you remember, Frankford Wayne Mastering Lab.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
out of Philadelphia. And there was a guy named Tom Steele who owned the lab and was in the top floor of 1697 Broadway. And he had this great cutter in there named Dominic Romeo, who was at, I believe he was at A&R, and then went to Media Sound when they had cutting there. And Tom saw me in the elevator one day, and he had known that Broadway recording was in trouble because they had leased all their new equipment to go into 24-track, or 16, actually, but they really wanted to go 24. But they had leased themselves into oblivion, and the studio was going under. So he got me an interview at Electric Lady with Bruce Staple, who was running the studio at the time. And
was this before or after Eddie Kramer?
No, Eddie was there in the beginning.
Okay.
Eddie was there from day one. Eddie was, I believe he was an engineering director early on. And then he was replaced by Ron Johnson, who was another great engineer. Ron recorded Little Eva's Locomotion.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
But Bruce Staple had Allegro Studios prior to that.
Oh, I remember that.
Allegro did all the work with Tommy James and the Shondells.
Yeah.
So Bruce interviewed me. I had several interviews with him, and he was a very interesting character. He was in a suit and tie at that time. And this is in the 1975. And Bruce interviewed me, and he asked me, finally on the third interview, he asked me to begin, and I said I had to give my employer 2 weeks' notice, but I could do orientation, and that's what I did. The first major project that I was a second engineer on was Chick Corea's Leprechaun album with Bernie Kirsch as the engineer.
Oh, Bernie's great, yeah. You know, I think that everybody that's listening to this wants to know more about Electric Lady, because you know it's such a venerable studio. It has the name value, the impact of the brand is still huge, and I think everyone's kind of curious. And you never hear too much about people that have worked at Electric Lady, and you know it's not like other studios, although you think it would be. So you worked with I guess all you had there was major acts, right? Because that was a big draw.
Well, we had major acts, but we had also artists that became major acts. I remember assisting Ron Johnson one time, who brought in this band from Brooklyn called Chic. And they were just street kids out of Brooklyn, supported by this guy named Lenny Fogel, who had a stereo store in Midtown Manhattan, and he was out of Brooklyn. He had financed their project, and Dance, Dance, Dance was one of the first records we worked on.
No kidding. So that's how that happened, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And Niall and Bernard and Tony, wonderful guys. Still, Niall is just still a great guy, you know, down to earth.
I read Niall's book, and I don't remember anything about that. About him saying that, you know, who the financier was.
Yeah, he was the guy. I remember Lenny. He had a Rolls Royce. He used to come in and park it on 8th Street. He was quite the character. But yeah, we had a lot of major acts. When Eddie came in, it was always major. Eddie had brought in the Stones. Eddie brought in Kiss. I had done at least 5 records with Kiss collectively. With Eddie, April Wine, the Canadian band.
Yeah.
Brownsville Station with Cubby Coda.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Did
you do Hall & Oates too?
I worked on Hall & Oates with Neil Kernan. I actually engineered some of it on Private Eyes. But I had known Daryl and John. They were locals, and they were managed by Tommy Mottola. And I had been working a lot with Kid Creole and the Coconuts as an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy had a whole catalog full of artists that he was developing and managing at the time before he went to Columbia or Sony.
Didn't you work on Led Zeppelin?
Yeah, with Eddie. I worked on the movie Song Remains the Same with Eddie. I had worked with him. We had John Paul Jones, Bonham, and Jimmy in the studio. I remember because it was Jimmy's 33rd birthday.
That's very cool.
Yeah, it was Jimmy's 33rd birthday, and they were in and out all the time. Eddie had brought them to the studio. This was after Glenn.
Glenn Johns, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Eddie was, you know, but it wasn't only Eddie. We had people like Chris Kimsey who came in. And
yeah.
Chris' first project, I remember with Chris, was Peter Frampton, Comes mm-hmm. Alive.
Frampton Comes Alive, you worked on. No kidding.
No, I didn't work on it. Chris did.
Oh, okay.
You that was Chris Kimsey, yeah. But yeah. We had a lot of, it was always interesting acts that were coming in. Rock acts and then a lot of jazz. I started assisting with Larry Rosen and Dave Grusin in the early days of GRP.
Wow.
And when Larry came out of his basement studio in Jersey. So we had, in the B room, we had the jazz acts. And in the A room, the more expensive room, were the heavy-duty rock acts. So I did work with people like, you know, Jeremy Steig and Eddie Gomez. Really interesting underground jazz guys. Carl Ratzer, mm-hmm. Another German, did a lot of international German jazz releases.
What was so special about Electric Lady, except for obviously the Hendrix connection and the vibe, but was it just a vibe thing or was there something special about the sound?
Well, I think the vibe was the most important. Electric Lady went through a number of electronic transformations while I was there. Remember that Jimmy started out with Eddie, John Storick, and a chief engineer named Shimon Ron. And they built a bulletproof kind of studio with a Datamix console, two Datamix consoles, one in the A room, one in the B room.
Didn't Record Plant have those too?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct. In fact, it was because Jimmy had been working with Gary Kellgren as well.
Yeah, okay.
So they brought the Datamix consoles into Electric Lady. In 1977, 2 years after I got that, the owners at the time, the Selbys, were looking to make an upgrade, and the staff recommended Neves. So we wound up putting a Neve 8078 in A and an 8068 in B. I'm trying to remember now, I think there was 48 channels with a jukebox in A with the 8078, and there was 32 channels in the B 8068.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big deal. Up to that time, we had, like I said, the Datamix consoles with MCI machines and one Ampex MM1000, which was a great machine.
Yeah.
All Ampex 440s. I remember with Kramer working on Kiss Alive 2 and having at least 8 machines going with tape loops and delays and recording and at wow. one time. Yeah, I mean, you know, we used Studio A and just ran as long a loop as we possibly could back in those days.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Then things changed. I mean, the 8078, I believe, came out to Mad Hatter out here.
Yeah.
Bernie bought it for Chick. And the 8068s, I don't know where they went, but I think they're gone. I think they have SSLs and the Focusrite. I think they put actually in an old Neve now back in A again.
Yeah, they put an API in. Oh, no, that's right. That's Record Plant, I think, put the API from Richard Barron's API. But that's different. You worked with Billy Idol, too, right?
Yeah, I got a break in 1980.
So we'll just start right in.
And what had happened was that Dave Whitman, who now works with the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, he got called to do, I think he was working on Scandal with Mike Chapman. And I had known Keith Forsey and Richie Zito and all those guys associated with Giorgio Moroder, and Keith Forsey asked me with Bill Coyne and Billy to work on Rebel Yell to pick up after Dave had left. And we started re-recording all these tracks because they had no drummer. And turns out one of my old friends, Tommy Price, was playing with Patti Smyth, and killer drummer, and I knew his attitude would have been perfect for Billy. And we had gone through a number of drummers, including Keith Forsey, who was also a fabulous drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And put Tommy in the band with Steve Stevens and Billy, and everything came together we recorded everything within 30 days almost.
So were they recording with the drum machine originally?
Well, Keith, it was one of the first hybrid albums, and the Lin drum was one of Keith's favorite tools. So, you know, on the multitrack, we always had Lin Sync and Simply Time Code, you know, with a track between them. In fact, I believe Rebel Yell, we recorded everything on 21 tracks, so we didn't have any... you know, just to have bumper tracks on all the code.
Yeah.
And we recorded there wasn't a dead space on that multi-track.
Wow.
So we had no holes at all. If there was dead space on a track, we filled it.
Yeah, that's the way it used to be, though, right?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, it was including effects, you know, the backwards toms on the break and Rebel Yell. And
oh, you recorded all the effects then?
Oh, yeah. A lot of it was recorded.
Yeah.
All that machine gun stuff on Steve Stevens' guitar solo, that's all Steve.
Oh.
A lot of that's Rockman.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, Steve is an interesting guy. Steve was people don't know that Steve was an innovative guy because he was an effects tester for Mike Matthews.
Oh, no kidding.
And Steve was just, at the time, a real wizard when it come to the sequence of effects, guitar effects in the chain, and how to use that in a live setting. What we did with Rockman, with the Rockman, the Tom Scholz Rockman, and delays, because that's what that is in front of it. It's modulated delay. From, I believe it was a PCM 41, not even a 42, a 41 at that time, in front of it. And he created this whole machine gun effect with it. I haven't heard anybody come close to that yet in using it in context in a solo like that.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding.
And then the rhythm guitars were all just straight Les Paul Custom through... I believe it was a 50-watt Marshall.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'd stand right next to the amp just so he can get all the feedback.
Yeah, yeah. Did you mix the record too?
I mixed half the record. I mixed I mixed half, and Dave Whitman mixed half.
So, okay, from there, how did you get to Capitol? Because you were you were at Capitol for what, 13 years, right?
11 years.
11.
Yeah.
And all as vice president of the students?
I've been out of Capitol 13 years, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So how did you get there? It seems like a big jump to go from being an engineer to suddenly being an exec.
Well, what happened was that I got a gig to come to Los Angeles to do a disco act at Larrabee. And I came out here after Rebel Yell. And mind you, this was also, let me think now when this was. No, it was right. It was after Rebel Yell. And I came out to do this act and to record and mix. So I looked up everybody at Oasis, which was Richie Zito and Dave Concours, all the guys I had met in New York, and Keith. And they were all working at which is now, I guess, Larrabee West. On Lancashire, the old Davlin.
Yeah, yeah.
Next to Schnee's.
Yeah.
And they said to me, do you want to work? And I said, sure. I said, what do you got in mind? They said, do you ever work in film? And I said, not really. A few things here and there on a soundtrack, but nothing ever big. They said, well, we got this little film called The Breakfast Club, and we're going to record score and the soundtrack for it. Would you be interested? Yeah, sure. What do I need to do? So that's where I learned about color rate SMPTE, and we had a mag machine there, so we'd lock Sony 3324s to mag machines and go right to the dub stage. I mean, it was my PhD in film, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And Richie Zito was producing a lot at that time, and he said, listen, I'm doing this record with this band called Life by Night. I'm going to do it at Capitol. Oh, great. And at the time, Charles Camelli was running Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great little room. We worked in the B room. It was my favorite room. I loved that console. I loved the staff. They always had all this old gear laying around to try. Jeff Minnick was the chief engineer, or actually before him, John. Oh, God, I can't think of his name now. At any rate, there was another chief before Jeff. Jeff was working there. But I always got along with the staff, and the staff was fantastic. And underrated. I always felt they were underrated. And I thought that was a tragedy because you could do things at Capitol you couldn't do anywhere else because of the experience and the availability of certain kinds of gear. And the maintenance was always great. They're always on top of it. So, and the mic collection was incredible. Anything you needed was there.
Yeah.
They had a mastering lab. They had Wally Troggett. And Wally wound up mastering a lot of records for me. I would always try and bring Wally business, try to bring the studio business, whatever I was doing, because I felt comfortable. I liked that it was a Neve room. At the time, there was a Quad 8 console still in Studio 8.
I remember those.
And Hugh Davies was still on staff there. David Cole was a second engineer. Peter Dell was a second engineer. Charlie Picari. They had so much talent there, and these guys were... You know, I felt overwhelmed being assisted by some of the experienced people that were there. And the old Quad A console, I never recorded on it, but you really had to know your gain structure because you could clip it really easily.
Yeah.
So you had to have the right selection of mics. And, you know, that console had replaced the Capitol console that they had built. I have pictures of it, actually, of the old Capitol consoles with the rotary pots that they had built on their own. So there were a lot of homebrew kind of items they had there, you know?
Yeah.
So the staff felt underwhelmed and, you know, they didn't feel like they were part of the recording community because it was a union studio. that they can never be as good as anybody else. Ironically now, right?
Yeah, right.
And I felt badly about that. And I had done work there with Berlin, with Richie Zito, Life by Night. I had done, Animotion. I mean, there was just so many acts that we had brought in. So around 1987, I had moved back to New York. I was living between New York, Brooklyn, and Los Angeles. I was living in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and Los Angeles. And I made a decision to, you know, come back to New York and just live a life here and just commute to California as necessary. I kept an apartment at the Oakwood for years in Toluca Lake. So I got a call in the summer of 1990. And it was this guy named Dave Lyman, who was a vice president of human resources, and said, "Would you be interested to come out for an interview?" I said, "For what?" He said, "To be director of Capitol Studios." And I said, "Sure, why not? It's not something that came to my mind first," I said, "but I'm open to talking about it." Well, they had been in a transitional period, and they were looking for a new director. The previous director had been removed by the staff, apparently. They were very unhappy. And you came as a recommendation by the staff. And I said, "Wow, that's an honor. I had no idea." And that was somewhere in the summer of 1990. So December of 1990, I took the position. I had no idea. They promised me so many things beforehand. I said Studio C's got to change. There was an 8108 and a Neve 8108 in Studio C. I said it has to go. I said the Urey 813s have to go. The room was in the wrong position. I wanted to do a kind of a console and cosmetic change. But it got to the point where I said, you know, I need to remove everything. It was a gut. And I didn't know anything about corporate. I didn't know how to appropriate funds for a project in a capital expenditure request, how to do it properly through channels. I made a lot of mistakes. And I did it deliberately in a way, because you get a little bit of leeway when you're new, especially that as an executive, all I had ever really done were record budgets as a producer. And I had no idea the formalities that were involved with a corporation. But I was tutored. I was given a lot of leeway too, because Joe Smith was running the company at the time, and I had developed a relationship with Joe. Joe was CEO president, and Joe was one of my heroes in the record industry. You couldn't find a classier gentleman with more knowledge and commitment to artist careers than Joe Smith at the time when he was at Warner's and Elektra with Mo Austin and Lenny Waronker and Steve Ross. And we still talk from time to time. And Joe said, "Look, you can do whatever you need to do." I was also producing records, still producing and engineering. And Joe said, "Look, I trust you. You're here because we want you. And that just don't blindside me. If something's coming up, you need to talk to me. You need to be open with me about it." And that was the relationship until he left. So they had promised me a console for Studio C and a renovation. It took me 3 years to get it. I had to work with, they had assigned me to a Harvard MBA, and he was going to be my tutor. He was fantastic guy. We still talk. And he and I spent a lot of time writing the first ever business plan for Capitol Studios. And at that time, in 1990, there were 250 studios in the greater Los Angeles area.
Yeah, there was a lot.
And we had a look at where our market share was, where we stood in relation to every other studio, and how to be competitive as a union studio with private studios. And all I could do was really work with what I had to work with. And I looked at the studio as like producing a band. I had this great talent. I had to exploit their best talents and somehow put them in a win position to do their best. At that time, just previous to my coming on in December, Paula Salvatore was hired. She was hired in August of 1990.
And she's still there.
Absolutely. And Paula, you know, Paula and I were like the mom and dad for the longest time in the studio.
And Paula was just coming from Sound City, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, and Paula was working at a studio basically selling machines to keep the lights on because she had so many financial challenges there. And, you know, Paul is just a very sweet, streetwise, very, very smart woman from Providence, Rhode Island, you know, and charming and knew how to get people to work together, but also knew how to keep the lights on, and she could make the numbers.
Yeah.
So we embarked, and the idea was that we were going to do something different because we could. And the idea I had was very simple. I would build a model 10 years out to know what not to do today. Mm-hmm. Or what not to buy. And who were our clients and what did they demand? And what did the name of Capitol signify in the audio community? Because you remember, if you go back to your record buying history, Capitol High Fidelity Records were a big deal. Capitol and EMI had worked together for the longest time after that transition to come up with the best manufacturing processes they could make.
Yeah.
Capitol had their own vinyl plant in Scranton, Pennsylvania. They had their another pressing plant out here in Atwater Village, which became our LADC, our LA Distribution Center for product.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Over in Atwater Village, which then became the archive. Mm-hmm. Les Paul told me that he had built the tower on his kitchen table with Johnny Mercer back in New Jersey.
Wow.
Then he said he and Jack Edwards had embarked to build the studios, and then they forgot to put the damn echo in, so I had to dig up the parking lot.
Huh.
He said, and then we built hallways too small that we couldn't push a piano through. They had a lot of interesting people back in the 50s sort of construct this first ever recording studio for the exclusive recording of music, not radio.
Yeah.
Not a soundstage for film. It was going to be a recording studio.
Yeah.
And so I went back and started digging through a lot of the stuff that was in there, including things on top of the shop. I mean, and in the echo chambers. believe it or not, there's a, you've been down the echo chambers, right?
No, I haven't been there. I've seen the pictures, but I haven't been there.
We should get Paula to get you to bring you down there one day. Go into the electrical maintenance room, just across from Paula's office, you go into this hatch that drops you down about 30 feet. You drop down the hatch, and then there's a 50-foot area where you go toward the area where the echo chamber rooms live, the eight chambers. And they're like freezer doors, you know, those locks on freezer doors, those big chrome handles.
Yeah.
They're trapezoid-shaped rooms with deck paint. And at the time when I got there, they were Voice of the Theater speakers with SM-81s. They had been using up to that point, before that, they were using RCA 77s.
Wow. That's a secret, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So at any rate, in that area, that 50 feet before the chambers, there were shelves, metal shelves, with all this old gear. Dolby 301s, you know, the stretchers.
Yeah.
The old Neve, those square, I'm trying to remember the number of the model number, but Neve limiters from the mastering consoles.
Yeah, yeah.
There were at least eight of them there.
Huh.
So I had Brent Averill make power supplies and for all of them, and had the tech shop put them back in the service. So I found all this old gear that was just hanging out. Nobody was using. Nobody knew what to do with it.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of resurrection, and to look at things and say, why not? If it's available, why can't we use it?
Yeah. You know, I want to delve into this more. I think we're going to have to do part two and talk more about this, but I want to get in one more question before we have to leave here. And that's what you're doing today. I know you're mixing a lot for HDNet Access TV, and question would be, what is different about mixing for television in your mind?
Well, everything in delivery is 5.1 with an LTRT fold down that I have to deliver. I also, when I was doing a lot for HDNet prior to Access, it was we were doing a series, so there's a timeline, and you have to be 2 weeks ahead in every timeline for QC. Anything that goes out FTP up to the servers of site of HDNet, now Access TV, has to be QC'd before it goes out. So things that come up, digital snats, artifacts, spikes, anything that goes beyond level, and I think I'm delivering the level now at minus 20, will broadcast.
Are you using a Luft's meter?
No. Okay. No, I have a Digi-C 24.
They're figuring that out, broadcast level.
Yeah, I just deliver at minus 20.
Yeah.
And so it's tricky. You have to, you know, you got Fletcher Munson in there depending on how loud you're monitoring. So I monitor everything here in my room is tweaked at 85.
Mm-hmm.
I have the JBL 4326 system with the subwoofer.
Mm-hmm.
And I have my room shot through the JBL system, that the digital alignment system.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I put pink noise, weighted pink noise through, and I clock each speaker at 85 dB. In my fold down, for the fold down, yeah, the fold down is the surrounds are set minus 3 with the LFE.
Yeah. Well, that's very cool. We're going to have part 2. I can see there's a lot more to talk to you about here. It seems like we just scratched the surface. So thanks for being with me today. And again, we'll have part two soon.
Bobby, thank you so much, man. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too, Michael. To find out more about Michael, go to relevantartists.com. That's relevantartists.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club, .club. Steve puts the show together and does a great job. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. See you next time.